argument this morning, we are happy to welcome students from the Academy. Are they here? How about from Altoona? Okay, would you stand so we can see who you are?
Oh,
wow, that's a large group.
Two buses.
It says 45 here. Well, welcome, Altoona students, and you may be seated now. Now that we've introduced you to have the court meet you, I'd like you all to meet the court. And I'll start on my far left. That's Justice Patrick Crooks. And to Justice Crooks's right is Justice Jeanine Geske. And to my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Don Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And to the far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I will now call next case, which is 96-0171, Richard Herman versus Town of Delavan, and Robert Gordon is representing Richard Herman. And before you proceed, I just have one more announcement, and that is that the students from Altoona will meet with Justice Geske at noon in the courtroom, as scheduled and planned. Mr. Gordon.
Good morning, Chief Justice Abrahamson and members of the court, Mr. Wassel. Our complaint alleges that in 1994, the Delavan assessor did the most constitutionally unforgivable thing that a statutory assessor can ever do, and that is to assess the entire town by using random and arbitrary formulas in flagrant disregard of the uniformity clause of the Wisconsin Constitution. It has always been the rule until now, as set forth in an unbroken string of this court's decisions and court of appeals decisions, that when a municipal assessment fundamentally fails to satisfy the Constitution, for whatever reason, that assessment is deemed to be void ab initio. It has also been the rule until now, in an unbroken string of this court's decisions and court of appeals decisions, that when municipal citizens make the extraordinary assertion that their entire municipal assessment is void ab initio, whether for a constitutional reason or for a statutory reason, that assertion can be raised in an independent court action, which is not subject to the procedural restrictions which may apply in the very different kind of case where a single property owner concedes that the underlying municipal assessment of the municipality is valid, and he or she simply challenges the amount of taxes that he or she has to pay on that concededly valid assessment. Now, we submit that the fundamental error that the Court of Appeals made here was to blur that critical distinction between these two very different situations, to ignore all of the earlier precedents of their own and of this court, and to disregard, in essence, the magnitude of what it means when a group of citizens attacks the very foundation of the entire municipal assessment.
Why couldn't you have brought that argument that you just made very well in front of the Board of Review? Why didn't you avail under the Section 70 and just indicate, the argument that you made is that this is basically unconstitutional. Can't you make that argument at the Board?
Certainly, it could have. There's no question that this argument, to the extent that they were going after their individual assessments, there is no question that that could have been raised in the Board of Review. But I think we're dealing, Justice Wilcox, with two separate rights here. One is the right of the individual to have his or her assessment be a certain amount. The other is the much more fundamental, inherent constitutional right for anyone who lives in a municipality to have the entire assessment made on a uniform basis.
Well, let's assume that that's true, that your argument is that it was not uniform, that it was unconstitutional. Still, wouldn't the Board of Review, wouldn't the procedure laid out by the statute, which the other side indicates is exclusive, why wouldn't that procedure be used here? And then you could go on and you'd have your certiorari, but you would have your motion to the Department of Revenue. Why would we create a separate?
Several answers.
After reading the complaint here and reading the briefs, I still don't know for sure what random and arbitrary lack of uniform assessment was done. I know that the lake owners were allegedly assessed in a different process than the inland owners, but that's all we know about it at this point.
Well, we don't know that, of course, because we were stopped at the motion to dismiss stage, so that we think we have clearly alleged enough under Levine and other cases of this court to get into court.
So. But couldn't you have done that at the board of review?
The individual people could have, with respect to their individual assessments, raised similar arguments at the board of review.
Well, let me put it a different way. Why was it impossible for you to raise these arguments at the board of review?
It was not impossible. It was just.
I think that's what Justice Wilcox is asking.
It was not impossible for individual plaintiffs to have raised their individual
plaintiffs. All of these people.
Yeah. All of the people in our suit, to the extent it included people whose taxes were at issue, could have gone to the board of review. To the extent the set of plaintiffs in this case or some other case might include individuals which, under this court's March decision, had no effect on their taxes may even have gone down. The March decision says very clearly that we are dealing with two separate issues, and when you are contesting the global assessment of the entire municipality, you don't have to and should not get into individual questions of what anyone's individual situations are. You instead have the separate constitutional right to, in essence, live in a community that assesses the entire municipality uniformly, so that going to the Board of Review is not a necessary prerequisite, because you can, in fact, under Marsh, raise this issue in an independent suit without regard to whether there is any pecuniary effect on your individual taxes.
But under Marsh, which was an 1877 case, there wasn't any obligation to go before the Board of Review, in the sense that the statute that we're looking at basically dates back to 1887. And I guess that's what... I don't read Marsh as giving, this carte blanche thing that it's been for 100 years, as I recall, the argument made in your brief that the taxpayers had the right to skirt the Board of Review, because Marsh is something where there wasn't a Board of Review process basically in the statutory sense that we have today. And secondly, this was where the assessor, I don't put the cases, they don't dovetail, because that was a case, as I recall, where the assessor was didn't have a personal inspection and then didn't file the affidavit that he individually looked at each piece of property, which is, seems to be a little different than what we're dealing with today.
Several answers, Justice Wilcox. The first one is that indeed the certiorari statute may not have been worded precisely the same, but in fact the Supreme, this court in Marsh and the Court of Appeals in our case notes that certiorari procedures and the Board of Review did exist in 1877. There was a slight dispute. I think the plaintiffs had alleged the Board of Review had not met. The defendants, the supervisors, alleged that the Board of Review had met. The trial court back then decided that the board had indeed met, and this court never addressed that factual issue. But that critical thing is that, which I think makes, is one of the reasons why we are disputing the logic of the Court of Appeals, is because certiorari procedures did exist in those days. The Board of Review did exist. The Supreme Court, in its lengthy decision there, does mention that certiorari procedures are available. The Court of Appeals picked up on that point, but I think the final conclusion of the Court of Appeals was incorrect, in that the because those procedures were available, if this court in 1877 felt the same way that the Court of Appeals did in this case, because those very procedures existed, logically this court would have said those procedures are available, you could have gone before the Board of Review and didn't. Therefore, the fact that the Supreme Court didn't do that with the same procedures in effect 120 years ago, I read it as meaning that this court is essentially coming to a different conclusion than the Court of Appeals did. Second differentiation, Justice Wilcox, is that the distinction, and the Court of Appeals made this too, in saying you are raising a uniformity violation here, a constitutional violation, whereas in Marsh it was more inherent and more basic because the assessor never signed the statutory roll. Well, I think that first of all, I think an ab initio case is an ab initio case. I don't think there's a ground for distinction. But just look at more fundamentally, if the in the pecking order and the priorities between a constitutional violation and the obligation of an assessor to follow the assessment statute, To the extent there was any doubt about where those priorities shake out, this court decided categorically 2 years ago in Levine that as between those two priorities, a constitutional violation by the assessor is infinitely more significant than a statutory violation by the assessor, because this court ordered the extraordinary relief of telling the assessor to literally go back, take the statute book, throw it away, and ignore it, because given the choice of violating the statute and violating the Constitution, you've got to violate the statute and uphold the Constitution.
I was just going to say that I think the difficulty I have with this is that when you have you're saying this is a constitutional violation, well, then what doesn't that open it up? What if we were to decide in your favor the way you would like this court to go? How do we detect or understand or appreciate the fact that this is a proper constitutional violation? Because won't that open it up to a lot of cases saying, well, the assessment is unconstitutional, it's not uniform, therefore we don't have to go before the Board of Review? That's what concerns me. You say, well, you didn't get past the motion to dismiss stage, but in the complaint itself, it seems like we're dealing with over-assessment, we're dealing with excessive assessments, which is something that can be taken care of under the statutory scheme. That's what I'm perplexed by as far as the constitutional argument here.
I understand, and certainly anyone standing up at this lectern and saying, you know, there is a constitutional right suggests that you're opening the doors to people with less serious cases than we have to come forward and open the circuit court doors to, you know, garbage in plain English coming in the guise of a constitutional claim. But I think given that we have, notwithstanding that, alleged a viable constitutional claim, I think that under Marsh and other ab initio cases in exemption areas and different areas, that we have a clear right to come in with what is essentially a different, somewhat different claim, in the sense that we are, I think it's somewhat extraordinary, and we haven't seen in years past cases or any case like this where a large gaggle of property owners comes in and makes the claim that our entire assessment is non-uniform. And I think to answer and maybe go outside the record to somewhat answer your question, maybe, you know, there have been other cases which this court can't look at. Other cases have gone forward on this assessment for these years and have in which the property owners have won on the merits. We obviously can't get into that here, but our complaint was just a notice pleading complaint that basically, you know, we were unable to get into the details of exactly, nor did we feel that we were required to get into the details of exactly what our allegations were as far as the uniformity violation in just drafting the initial complaint.
Mr. Gordon, in the last answer that you just gave, are you talking about some of the 89 property owners here did follow the statutory scheme to conclusion?
There are some certiorari cases that I believe have involved our people raising their individual assessment cases, as distinguished as a matter of what the allegation is from this case, in which they are all joining to say, as citizens of Delavan, this assessor up and down and sideways had everything wrong, and the entire assessment should be thrown out.
Did they make that claim in their individual actions too?
I believe that my understanding is that in the individual cases, it was limited to the fair market value issue, what the fair market value of their property should be, rather than the global idea that our entire municipal assessment. No one in the certiorari case requested relief of tossing the entire municipal assessment.
And I'm assuming that if it was unconstitutional in year whatever, 1990 blank, unless there's been a dramatic change, it's unconstitutional for the year 1997 also.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there's opportunity for taxpayers to make that challenge.
That's correct, and cases are proceeding for those years, although once again, as this court knows, every year stands on its own. So with respect to the assessment of the town standing or falling on its unconstitutionality, 1994 is a separate year that is proceeding in this court in this fashion.
Wasn't the market value of the property determined in order to apply the rate to it so that you'll arrive at the tax on each of these properties? Wasn't the market value used as a guide to determine the assessment?
In theory, the assessment would equal the fair market value. Our position has been that by using these formulas that this assessor got everything so far out of whack that...
Your position is they're not really using fair market value.
That's correct.
Therefore, it's unconstitutional because it's not uniform.
More basically, not because fair market value wasn't used, but basically because of the uniformity clause that requires properties to be assessed uniformly. By using the formulas, and this is in essence what this court decided in Levine and what the Court of Appeals decided in Noah's Ark, by using an arbitrary method, as the court's familiar with from the Levine situation, by using a random arbitrary method that does not consist of going to each property and measuring and looking at it, that is the violation by definition. Is the uniformity violation the same way this court found in Levine?
Can you tell us what those various formulas were that were used in order to arrive at value?
Once again, this is outside the record because we never got into that.
It's not relevant because what you're fighting is just to stay in court.
Right, to stay there and certainly have the right. We're not here on the merits, and I think that once we've alleged, I think there's never been a dispute that our pleading was deficient in the sense of not alleging enough to...
And you don't expect this court to say this tax is constitutional or unconstitutional. You want this court
to
say...
No.
That it's an opportunity to make a claim.
Absolutely correct. We have never gotten into with our first deposition.
You want us to say that you don't have to exhaust your remedies as provided by three or four statutes.
Or to our point, suggests that you do not even get into these statutes and you don't get into the question of exhaustion because of the allegation that
you
made.
Well, it's the same thing as saying you don't have to exhaust. Your argument is you don't have to exhaust because it doesn't fall under those statutes.
Correct.
But why, and I think this is just another way of saying what Justice Wilcox said is, look, we've got at least three, if I counted right, probably more, statutes that tell taxpayers how to fight the assessment, right?
That's correct.
The usual rule is if there are statutes that give you a remedy, especially an administrative remedy, and tell you how to appeal from it, those statutes are exclusive. You got to use them. That's the general rule, right?
Correct, sure.
And one reason for that is that there's certainty. You know, there's a map, and you follow it. And you're asking us to move outside that route, that map. And you know, I'm sure, that you can always raise a constitutional issue, or almost always, right?
Of course.
And if we accept that, that you could raise a constitutional issue outside this statutory route, then aren't you allowing the taxpayers to avoid going to the local government, as these statutory provisions state, and come right into court? And that's just contrary to the whole tax scheme.
It is in that limited sense, Justice Abrahamson, but at the same time, this court decided Marsh 120 years ago. There has not been gaggles of taxpayers coming in to raise these claims, and nothing has really ever overruled.
On the other hand, the Court of Appeals had a very appealing way of differentiating and distinguishing Marsh.
And I think that several of those, if I can get into that, I think several of those ways that they distinguished Marsh, and indeed the Court of Appeals did not say that Marsh has ever been overruled or criticized by this court. They just tried to distinguish it on several grounds, which I want to address. The first was just this issue of whether it was dicta or whether it was necessary to the opinion. In the first place, I think, before you even get into that, now that we are here and this case is being decided on the merits of the jurisdictional issue in this court, it's completely beside the point to delve into whether there's any technical, whether technically that was dicta or not.
Let me interrupt you just for a second. It fits sort of in what you were saying before you started the Marsh analysis. The amicus brief by Wisconsin Towns Association, League of Wisconsin Municipalities, addressed a lot of what the Chief Justice was just talking about. And they wrote in there to require the property owners to put the taxation district on notice of alleged defects in the assessment procedures at the time of the Board of Review will help ensure fair and equitable assessments in a timely fashion. It will give them an opportunity to take appropriate steps to correct defects and in a timely manner, as opposed to waiting, as in this case, where the claims were made nearly 3 months after the first tax installment occurred. I'm concerned about the policy and some language that the Chief Justice indicated, that towns and municipalities certainly rely on this tax base as income, and if we don't require the timely filing as required by the statutes for these claims, there's no certainty as to the tax income for these municipalities, and it makes the planning very difficult.
It does, and certainly there's that aspect is in there as once again, I you know, that we have a 100-year-old precedent that has never that still exists today. I think that, you know, that...
Well, the question is whether how clear that was, that everybody knew that they didn't have to follow the tax.
Okay, it's the other side of the bench on which that issue of whether it exists will be decided, but I think I thought of either the town's brief or the league's brief in terms of that, you know, could the statute be kept open for 6 years? I guess, conceivably, a latches argument, the defense could be raised if someone waits too long to raise it. Here, we're talking about people coming in. The initial claim that we had to file under DNRV Waukesha was filed fairly quickly after I think it was March or April, I believe, of that first year. So we're not conceivably down the road, and I'm not suggesting that 6 years of the general 6-year statute would necessarily apply. I would like to think that some latches defense might be made if.
But you concede this is potentially a problem for municipalities.
Oh, certainly. It certainly is. There's no question about that.
Counsel, I'm not overly impressed with a 100-year-old precedent, particularly given that there's been subsequent legislation, and we, of course, take cases all the time to determine whether laws should be given a second look or whether the law needs development. So outside of that 100-year-old precedent, I sit back and I ask myself, why is this respected law firm doing this? Why don't you want to go to the Board of Review and then carry your appeal through an orderly process? What's your problem?
I think that for these taxpayers, as wanderers to come in and attack the entire assessment. And, granted, the 100-year-old case is 120 years.
You're not doing too well in answering my question.
No.
Well, what's your problem? Why don't you want to go to the Board of Review?
We have gone to the Board for years, in which certainly we go to the Board of Review all the time for years.
For what?
We go to the Board of Review all the time for years.
These 89? I'm asking you in this particular case, why do you want to avoid them? A decision has been made to fight this. You guys have decided to fight this. You don't want to go to the Board of Review, and I can't figure out why.
Okay, but we came into the case after the board was over.
The time period
had lapsed.
That's the answer.
I assume that you filed with the Board of Review for the next year on your time.
That is correct.
The question is, you're just doing this for this year. That's the
1994 is the only year.
Now, otherwise, you've lost the year. But on the other years, you've gone through the Board of Review, so you're protected on those. If you win on this, you can dump those cases, come right into court. If you lose on this, you're protected for future years. Is that the point?
For 95 and 6 and 7, we are in court outside this.
Counsel, you
were... If I can just follow through then to the next question. Why would the next group of taxpayers, counsel, who don't have any statute of limitations problems or any of that, why would they want to avoid the Board of Review?
I think, once again, this is the level, and once again, because the complaint is just, a bare-bones pleading, I think the ability to come in, this is an extraordinary case in the sense of the town-wide botching, if I may, of the original assessment. If the ordinary person comes in and just tries to get out of court and just say, I want my individual assessment changed because I don't like it, and mumble something about...
Because of a constitutional...
Yes.
Why do you want to avoid the Board of Review?
I think they would be thrown out of the Board of Review if they didn't have a serious constitutional case. Or they would be thrown out of court.
They would be thrown out of court. Serious constitutional challenge, right?
They would be thrown out of court if they came into court in the independent action and could not show a serious constitutional violation on behalf of the entire assessment.
Well, it would seem to me you're saying, well, this is a rare situation, but I think the way that at least I see that this is couched and phrased here is that this is almost, it could be standard operating procedure because maybe you're just saying in your experience this is a rare, but I did remember going before the Board of Review in many different cases, and I think if this becomes standard operating procedure, I would suggest to you that there will be many entities that will be using the constitutional avenue if this court sets it up. So we can't just think about this particular case. That's one of the things. How would we by opening up this avenue, what restrictions would be on it? Then any group of taxpayers could allege that there was a constitutional violation. This is what concerns me. Avoid the statutory comprehensive scheme and go right to, forget going to first base, come right home and then get into the ballpark that way. Isn't that a problem?
It's a problem, but certainly, as I said, the person that thinks they have a serious constitutional case, you know, appreciates the court's problem and opening
the
door.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to think that they have a serious constitutional case. That's my point.
And circuit courts, hopefully, will toss out the ones that are not serious, which is, you know, one of the...
Well, if it just completely circumvents the Board of Review, we just would have all these...
Except the one point that, if I may, just before my time is up, keep in mind, it's asserted that only last term the Court of Appeals decided the Caledonia case, in which actually we were the ones asking this court to take, and this court declined to review. Caledonia essentially holds that as intertwined and intricate and everything else as these statutes are, and I think the Court of Appeals, is one of the Court of Appeals' main points was, Board of Reviews are the appropriate places to raise all of these factual issues in the first instance. Well, in Caledonia, which is court declined to review, the Court of Appeals said when the legislature passed Section 7437 back in, I think, 1953, the legislature intended that this is not a full limited procedure. You can go to the Board of Review, finish, and then essentially disregard and throw away everything that happened, start again with an independent action in the circuit court as a refund claim, and then you get a circuit court trial, circuit court jury, etc. So that I think the Court of Appeals, by deciding Caledonia the way they did, essentially undercut a lot of their position in this case by saying that these statutes are indeed not as global and exhaustive as they could be.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gordon. You will have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Justice.
Mr. Wassel, you represent the town of Delavan and the town of Delavan Board of Review.
Correct, Your Honor. May it please the court, and thank you and good morning, Your Honors. The question that has been asked of this court is to apply State Ex Rel State Ex Rel Levine versus Board of Review, and have that give rise to a substantive cause of action and ignore the statutory framework that exists. That's not what the legislature contemplated, nor is it what you should be looking at today either. The taxpayers assert that they are contesting indeed their entire assessment in this case. However, if you look at the complaint, that is not the case. These are 89 individual taxpayers who are indeed contesting their each individual assessments. And the remedy that they seek is not only contained in the ad damnum portion, but also in the body of the complaint. Now, I believe that Justice Babbage perhaps got to the core of this issue when he asked the question of my esteemed colleague as to why we're here today. And that's clear, because these particular taxpayers did not properly avail themselves of the timetable or time limits that they could have engaged in by going to Board of Review and following one of the many and variegated statutory processes by which they each individually or collectively could have been accorded relief.
Well, now, could the Board of Review declare the whole assessment unconstitutional?
Absolutely. Although that's not a likely scenario, 70.47(10) does provide that the town Board of Review in this case may set aside the entire assessment and order a reassessment. Similarly, there are other statutory animals, if you will, that provide for that very type of relief under 7437, which dovetails you with 74.39, a court-ordered reassessment.
The question was whether the Board of Review has authority to declare this unconstitutional.
And indeed they do.
What article, is that Article 3? What kind of jurisdiction is a Board of Review so that it would have the authority to declare anything unconstitutional?
Well, certainly they don't sit as your honors do and make perhaps constitutional determinations, but they do have the authority, as was the case in Levine, which came up via certiorari under 70.47, that came through Board of Review. And similarly, this case could have come through Board of Review, but it did not. The bottom line, however, is that consistent with the legislative scheme of exhausting remedies, that this particular Board of Review could have examined this assessment and said, this is wrong. Whether they used, per se, the uniformity analysis or just simply said this is wrong, they did indeed have that authority under 70.47 paren 10.
One of the things that bothers me in this case is the statement actually made by your opposing counsel. If something is void ab initio from the beginning, it's void from the beginning. Using the tax exempt case as an analogy. And so the argument is, if this is void from the beginning, then there are no procedures that would apply, that could apply, that would have power to apply something that is void. It doesn't exist. So it makes no sense to require procedures to apply to nothingness. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad that you characterized it as being bothered by what my opposing counsel said, because I will try to...
I thought I was bothered by the issue.
I understand. I'm going to try to fan that flame, if I may, and by telling the court that the Court of Appeals, I think, properly reasoned in this case that there is a distinction between that which the Marsh case indicated was void ab initio, i.e., the assessor didn't view properties, didn't go out, sign the roll, the physical or mechanical aspects of actually doing the assessment, versus a situation where an assessment is made and there is simply a complaint that the assessment was not done uniformly. The Court of Appeals reasoned, and I believe properly so, that there is a distinction or a difference between contesting the assessment as to whether it even occurred versus whether the assessment was done properly or validly pursuant to the Constitution. If indeed the determination is made subsequently that there is a constitutional violation, one could argue that it is indeed void ab initio. And I believe that that's what Levine stands for, is that if indeed there is a constitutional violation, that it is indeed void.
So why should plaintiffs be thrown out of court? Let's say this is unconstitutional and it's void. Why should they be thrown out of court? Because they didn't comply with steps, with regulations that have no application.
Well, I believe that the analysis here that the legislature undoubtedly undertook was this. They did not, and if you look at the historical evolution of 7047, 7437, and 7085, you'll see that there have been obstacles to taxpayers running to the courthouse over the years. There have been the requirement that they pay their taxes, whether it be in part or in full, that they attend Board of Review, and so on. The mere fact that a taxpayer makes an allegation, whether it's a single taxpayer or a group of taxpayers, while it's true that it may be an exercise in futility to attend Board of Review or have that proceeding be meaningless if indeed the only issue is one of uniformity, that obstacle or roadblock still exists. Why? Because Board of Review could, as we indicated under 7047.10, could order a comprehensive reassessment, which may rectify the matter and thus avoid the courts.
But that very requirement that they pay taxes, I mean, Marsh treats that and doesn't use the failure to meet a conditioned precedent as an impediment to maintain an action. So.
No, and I understand that, and I believe that the distinction here is that, and again, if you, the Court of Appeals treated it as a footnote, and I perhaps think it's perhaps a little more important than a footnote, the determination in Marsh was one of a question of law, whether the statutory requirements were complied with by the assessor. Whereas when you get into the issue of the uniformity of the assessment, it becomes a question of fact. And that's an important distinction. Why? Because the Board of Review does sit as a quasi-judicial/legislative body, and they themselves can undertake that distinction. whereas a question of law, they cannot. When you look at Marsh, it's somewhat similar to the Friendship Village line of cases where there was no tax from the very beginning. If the property itself is tax exempt, then it makes no difference whether the people do or do not go to Board of Review. And it's easy to sidestep it under those circumstances because there should be no impact to the municipality budget-wise, as was addressed previously, if indeed the property should not have been subject to a taxation from the beginning. Now, what I wanted to stress, I guess, is that there are remedies available, and those remedies do require the taxpayer, again, whether singly or in combination, to go through certain steps. In this instance, each of those remedies has prescribed limitations, or statutes of limitations, if you will, and we've set those forth in the brief. In this instance, none of those were complied with, which is why we're here. What this court is risking doing is essentially creating what would amount to a judicial statute of limitations, because the only legal statute of limitations that exists, a legislative one, is the catch-all provision that grants a six-year statute. Absent some determination, and the argument was made this morning that latches might apply. Well, I can't recall the last time that was looked on too terribly favorably by any court. So what we're stuck with is a six-year period of time where we can go back and retroactively, and this court in Levine recognized the practical difficulties in even going back to the prior tax year. And this would, a determination in this instance that would allow these taxpayers to proceed forward, the net impact of that would allow six-year retroactivity based upon our current statutory scheme. With regard to that very statutory scheme, we consider it to be a patchwork quilt. Each of those statutes has within it a separate proviso that says that if you go to door number one, you're precluded from going to door number two or door number three. And similarly, when you do go to door number two, you can't go to one and three, and so on. In this instance, what we're doing, or what the taxpayer is asking this court to do, is to ignore the exclusivity of each of those statutory procedures. And to say, we can, just because we allege a constitutional violation, treat that as a separate and independent cause of action. We have maintained throughout the course of these proceedings, Your Honors, that this indeed is a claim for an excessive assessment. We have 89 individual taxpayers who are coming in and saying that we have been overassessed. They have asked as a remedy that there be a reassessment, but they have not alleged in their complaint that the entire assessment was wrong. They have said lakefront properties. Now, the distinction is one where if you look at 7437 and 7439, there is statutory authority for the court, the circuit court, to order a reassessment. But in order for that to be occasioned, there has to be certain timetables complied with. So the mere fact that we are pulled the notion of uniformity out of the Constitution and dovetailed and bootstrapped that with Levine, that now that gives rise to a separate and independent cause of action, notwithstanding any of those self-contained statute of limitations, doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And the bottom line is that to allow that to take place would tear apart that very patchwork quilt that the legislature, I think, over time has worked so hard to achieve.
Counsel, in response to my earlier question, you referred to the Court of Appeals opinion, with the Court of Appeals indicating that questions of tax exemption are questions of law, no need for evidentiary development, and therefore don't have to go to a Board of Review. They can come right into court. The slip opinion, page 12, the Court of Appeals says that, and you endorse that in your argument. And yet, what immediately came to mind, because we're talking about in the there's a Friendly Village case, Friendship Village, tax exemption. What immediately came to mind is a scenario where you have a group saying, I'm a church, and so therefore I'm tax exempt. Doesn't that require fact development?
It's actually the case law provides that it is a mixed question of law and fact.
So isn't the Court of Appeals in error when it indicates that a claim that property is exempt from taxation is a pure question of law and as such is not dependent upon the development of evidence in a board review hearing. That basis of distinction seems to not
I believe, I understand what Your Honor's concern is, but I believe that the conclusion that is set forth in that footnote is one that is that once you do develop the facts, the ultimate legal determination is a legal one by applying the law to those facts. We can't take a Friendship Village situation and try that case to a jury. Ultimately, a judge will make that determination.
So what's your conclusion from all of that?
The conclusion is that we do have a framework within which any one or more taxpayers must operate. And the fact that Marsh in 1877 said if the statutory procedure was not followed and he or she as assessor didn't sign the document or didn't do a hands-on assessment, that makes the assessment void ab initio, that in and of itself does not give rise to a separate standalone cause of action that would ignore the scheme that now exists.
Now, there's a practical reason why somebody may not want to go to the board, and I just read an investigative article by a newspaper that said that people don't like local boards of zoning and board of review and other boards that have a lot of power and discretion because there's a sense that local politics is the worst kind of politics, and that what neighbors think and what neighbors' financial interests may be have too great an effect on the decision-making of these local boards. Now, that may be true in Wisconsin, it may not be true, it may be true in the town of Delvin, it may not be true, but that this seemed to have been a sense around the country, and that therefore, if you're going to attack the whole assessment, it seems as if a board of review and other local city officials, town officials, would be very protective. It's their employees. They've had a hand in carving this out, etc. So what do you think of that, and maybe you got to get it out of the local?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have privy to the same newspaper article that you read, but nonetheless...
Sounds familiar, though, doesn't it?
Well, it's something that makes common sense, and I guess my response, first of all, would be that if you're dissatisfied with your local governmental officials, there's a remedy for that unto itself, which is resolved at the polls, as you all know, being in that very same position. So if you don't like the job that your people are doing, you get rid of them and get other elected officials in there that will indeed do the job. And I know that sounds somewhat glib, but I believe that that's the remedy that can be accorded to people. The second thing that I wish to point out is that in many municipalities, the assessor is an elected official. They can be appointed, but in many instances they themselves are elected. So there may be a divergence between the elected board and the elected assessor, which unto itself may create a whole new set of facts. So I believe that the legislature, in its wisdom, decided let's not allow people to contest their taxes in the circuit courts and now at this level, but rather let's make them deal with the people. After all, if it's a local governing body who establishes the levy and goes through and approves budgets, that control should remain. And it's those very people who the taxpayer goes to first.
One of the things that I noticed in your brief was that you many times indicated it was the failure to allege compliance that was fatal. And you said that enough times, emphasizing the alleged, not failure to comply that was fatal, but failure to allege compliance that is fatal. Why'd you do that?
Because as I understand, well, what we have with 89 taxpayers is a mishmash or myriad of facts. And what I mean by that is that, and I believe that this is part of the appellate record, there are statutory requirements under 7047, 7437, and even 7085 that require attendance not only of board of review, but payment of taxes and so on down the line. with respect to these taxpayers, some of them complied with some of the requirements, some of them complied with other requirements, and it's very difficult to properly gauge who did what, but we did go through that analysis, and ultimately we concluded that it was important that the complaint, in order to sustain a cause of action, should at least state statutory compliance, which it failed to do.
You cited this many pages, and yet, I mean, I have 11, 12, 26, 36, but you never cited any authority for the proposition.
Well, the complaint on its face, and complaints, of course, are to be liberally construed, and you know, we deal with a notice type of pleading. The question before the circuit court is whether, under any circumstances, the facts as pled give rise to a cause of action. And because there is no allegation that the statutory scheme that has been put in place by the legislature was complied with, the complaint must fail. And the circuit court believed that, and as well as the Court of Appeals. And I believe that that issue has been dealt with by virtue of their failure to allege the requisite facts. Whether it be a jurisdictional fact or otherwise, it is a necessary or factual predicate to their complaint.
The law used to be, with regard to notice of injury and claim, that when you alleged, when you brought a lawsuit, you had to allege that you filed notice of injury and claim in the municipalities, and it was denied. And failure to allege that was fatal to the complaint. That's with regard to notice of injury and claim to governmental entities. And I don't know that there's any law that says that with regard to assessments.
Well, what I'm getting at, Your Honor, there in that regard is that in order to bring the action in circuit court, that action would be brought only by virtue of the three statutes that we've talked about repeatedly. And without those statutes, there is no cause of action. In other words, this is a statutory, not a common law cause of action, at least as we perceive it. And it's without those statutes, there's no cause of action. So it would therefore be necessary to allege compliance with those statutes in order for your complaint to survive. There are no other questions, Your Honors? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wassel. Mr. Gordon, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, let me try to address Justice Bradley's points and hopefully leave her less troubled in 5 minutes than more troubled. As to the last point, we did not plead these items because our cause of action is not one under 7437 or these other statutes. If we were bringing our suit under those statutes, we would have pled it because we were bringing it under what I'm calling the Marsh cause of action. We didn't feel it necessary to do, although there is evidence in the record because of the town's affidavits and the motion to dismiss that was essentially converted, that I think 43 of our people did go to the Board of Review. With respect to Justice Bradley, to your more, I guess, substantive points, yes, the Board of Review can't declare the entire assessment unconstitutional under subsection 10, which Mr. Wassel mentions. They can open up the entire town and say something is going on here, call properties who didn't object into a hearing, but go through them one by one by one by one, rather than just say we're throwing the whole thing out. They've got to go through one by one by one individual assessments. So to answer your question, I think, yes, there is no way that a global determination that this is out the window, we've got to start all over again, can happen until and unless someone brings, you know, this kind of independent action. With respect to your point on the distinction between the other ab initio cases, yes, the exemption cases, it's not just Marsh for us, it's all the exemption cases that have gone on year after year through the family hospital in the 70s and all the cases in the 30s and 40s and through IBM versus Alloway. Consistently, this court has said, if something is ab initio, it's void, it never existed to begin with. All that the Court of Appeals was able to do was to try to make this allegation or conclusion that one feels like a factual case and one feels like a legal case. But you have the same exact two-part standard in both cases. You determine the facts. You determine whether those facts meet the relevant legal standard. That's the same in an exemption qualification case as in this kind of a case. They're inherently factual. Milwaukee Protestant Home says that. Prairie du Chien Sanitarium says that. Friendship Village cites both of those cases on the point that they're inherently factual cases. So I think there is really no distinction between the two types of cases. It's not just Marsh, it's all the exemption cases that say if something is void ab initio, you don't have to go to some administrative agency. The assessment is void as if it never existed in the first place. With respect to 7554 and the idea of global reassessments, yes, Mr. Wassel's correct. You can bring it under a 7437 suit, but you don't have to. We've cited Marina Fontana, Hemker v. Cuggett, all these other cases where which applies 7554 in a different situation and orders a global reassessment. Indeed, if the town was right, this court in Levine, what this court did in Levine is say, we have the power to order a global reassessment, but they're reassessing next year. This would be frightening. We will just order limited relief here, but certainly reaffirming we have the power to order a full reassessment. That power exists here, and I think if the town were correct on 7554, this court would have said in Levine, we don't have the power to order it because you can only do it under the statutory scheme that the town suggests, which is a 7437 suit. You didn't do that in Levine, so I think that impliedly means that a global reassessment is something that can be ordered in any case, not just a 7437 case. Last point is to come back to the Chief Justice's point about the newspaper article. Certainly we're not suggesting that just because people don't like Board of Reviews, there should be a way around it. Once again, if you've got to go to the Board of Review, if you're just challenging your individual assessment, you've got to go to the Board of Review. We believe here that there's a separate claim that's been made, a separate cause of action, and a separate assertion that as citizens of the municipality, we have the right to have our entire village or town assessed uniformly. And indeed, under Marsh, the people that could not raise it if they had to go to the Board of Review, but could raise it here, are those whose taxes don't go down, whose taxes don't change, and there's precise language in Marsh that addresses the situation of those particular people. And just as a final point, was to come back to Caledonia, because I think that what the Court of Appeals said in there, that this court declined to review, there really is an inalterable inconsistency between those two, in that Caledonia now says that this exhaustive, self-contained, self-intertwined set of procedures now no longer has to be followed. You can get a direct action come in, throw out what happened below, and if you can start again in the trial court with a de novo action under Caledonia, logically to be consistent, you should have to do that here. My light is on, Madam Chief Justice, and the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The court is in recess until tomorrow at 9:45. The students can remain here, please, and Justice Geske will be out to speak with them.